Thanks a lot. I used to do this all the time, you know, go around to universities. It was a big part of my job at the Free Software Foundation. I do a lot less of it now that I'm at the Software Freedom Law Center. I'm going to talk a little bit about the whole story of how I changed from one place to another and why I did that. But the first and primary thing I want to do is start to talk about what the issues are politically and philosophically about this whole thing called free software. It's generally known under the business term open source, which is probably how most of you have heard about it. It's just a different term for it that was coined as a way to market the whole idea to businesses. The reason I talk about it as free software and the issue of software freedom is because I'm more focused on the rights and freedoms that you get with the software and making sure that you have certain permissions every time you get a copy of a software program to improve it, to modify it, to redistribute it, to make money from it if you'd like, to not make money from it if you don't want to. And that's why I got involved in this whole thing called the software freedom movement. Now, most software comes with a copyright license. Usually that restricts your rights. What we do in the free software world is we use that copyright license to ensure certain rights and freedoms that you get with software. And I'm going to talk more about that in a little bit. Now, this whole thing, all this open source and free software that's out there, wasn't created in a vacuum. In fact, it was pretty well planned out by a lot of different people. And it faced a lot of struggles. And for a long time, it was on a collision course with proprietary software. Because this old regime of the way of doing software was so radically different. Now most of the people who used to do proprietary software have by and large seen the value of open source and free software and have adopted it. So that collision course isn't really the same, but I'm going to talk about another collision course that we're on right now with a whole different industry. And I'm going to tell you the story by telling the story of four different men who have done various things all related to this, totally basically separate, and have sort of all ended up in this same sort of area. Well, the first one is the one you probably, if you came to my talk a couple of years ago, if you're on the faculty, you've heard about him before. He's relatively famous. His name is Richard Stallman. And he founded the Free Software Foundation and sort of created this whole idea and this whole movement. And the situation quickly became really high stakes because it was a question of cultural and legal systems about how things should operate in the digital age. And this is what Stallman's always been focused on. And it started as a pretty optimistic story. In the 1970s, Richard Stallman was an undergraduate at Harvard University. He wandered down Main Street in Cambridge to the MIT campus and found they had a computing lab that had open terminals, and he logged in and he started fooling around. Eventually, he got hired as a part-time while he was a student, and after he graduated, he got a full-time job working at the MIT labs in Building 43, which is now actually gone. But it was really the golden age of academic computing because it was a time when there wasn't lots of different walls between how people worked on software. People who had access to software in universities in those days could readily share that software. They got all the source code from the vendor. They could improve it, change it, modify it, and it was shared among various different universities, and it was always done that way throughout the late 1970s and the early 1980s. And after a while, as it headed into the mid-80s, the MIT environment began to change. And in fact, most of the computing world began to change. You know, at MIT, there was more sort of patenting of technology, and people were spinning off proprietary software companies off of the software they had developed inside MIT. And what happened was various walls were constructed among who could work with whom and what kind of collaboration could happen. And this was due to the invention of something called the software license. The idea that software would be completely separated from hardware. When you bought a piece of hardware, you didn't actually get the software for it, and you had to go license that from somebody else. Now, I don't know if this story is true or not, but it's often credited that another Harvard student, who in fact had never met Richard Stallman while they were there, named Bill Gates, is the inventor of the idea of licensing software. Now, that may be apocryphal, maybe not, but it's certainly true that when Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard, he didn't actually finish, our buddy Stallman did, and he went to, John's giving me a hard time in the front row about that. It's true, hey, it's true. So he got with some friends, and they started writing an operating system, or actually really was sort of a shell on a file system. I really can't qualify it as an operating system, for the new IBM PC that was coming out. And he walked into IBM's offices and said, I don't want to let you have or sell you the software. I want to license it. I want every computer to have it, and I want a license to be paid to my company every time somebody gets a copy. This may have been the first software license ever. It maybe not. And if it wasn't, it was certainly the biggest release of licensed software to that date, when the IBM PC came out with Microsoft DOS on it. Now, this effect was really rampant across the industry. And it's actually sort of an ironic thing, because the reason you can do this with software is there's this weird artifact of the way computers work. And that's the separation of source code and binary. Once you had higher-level languages that had the idea of a compiler, you could turn some source code into something the computer could understand, binary, and that was obfuscated to the human. They had to look at the source code, run it through a compilation process, and get the binary on the other side. And this, there's no particular reason, sort of philosophically or cosmically, that it had to be this way. It just turned out that we built digital computers using binary, and that's what computers understood. So you had to make the instructions in that form. But we didn't like writing in binary. I know some people probably did, but most of us didn't. So, you know, you move to assembler, and then you move further to higher level languages, and suddenly you have this separation, source code and binary. And I don't actually think proprietary licensing could have existed without the separation, because once you get the source code, you have a lot of rights and privileges automatically just because you have it in your hands. But because of this separation, we get software licensing. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about the issue of digital restrictions management, DRM, which you may have heard about. And one of the lawyers I work with said to me recently something really interesting. He said, you know, the separation of source and binary is actually sort of a rudimentary type of DRM. It's a rudimentary way to keep you from getting access to the stuff on your computer. And I want you to keep that in your mind for when I think talk about DRM a little bit later. So for me, you know, being in my mid-30s now, I grew up in a completely proprietary software world. Because by the mid-1980s, when I got my first computer, you didn't get source anymore. There was nothing like getting source for your computer. You got a programming language most of the time, but you had to write your own software if you wanted source code to software. All the software you got from companies and so forth came in binary form. I think I was in my late teens, around 18 or 19, before I ever actually got a program with source code from someone else. And that's a weird thing for a child trying to learn about computers, to never see source code. How do you learn about computers without ever seeing source code? I don't know. Maybe you can learn about the hardware, but you certainly can't learn about the software that way. So while this was all happening, this collapse of the academic computing environment, Stallman, for his part, saw his world collapsing around him. This world of software sharing, this world where people collaborated to build better software together in the idea of advancing science, that was ending. So he made a decision to start this thing called the GNU Project. And I could give you a whole talk about the history of the GNU Project, but I'm not going to today. The key thing that came out of it, and the key thing that I think matters most today, is the idea of the copyleft license. See, what Stallman did when he started writing this free software, he wanted to write software that was building communities in the same way he'd seen his MIT community exist. Software that would allow people to collaborate and share and work together that would totally be separate from this proprietary software system that was now becoming the standard and the norm. So he designed a software license. He took the copyright system that had been used traditionally to control and lock up and proprietarize software, and he turned it into something different. He said, let's write a license that does the opposite of what licenses usually do. Instead of telling what you can't do, saying when you get a copy of a software program, you can't see the source code, you can't modify it, you can't distribute it and share it with other people, you can't resell it and make money from it. Let's write a license that says you can do all those things, that you can see the source code, that you can improve it yourself, that you can share it with your friends or build businesses and make money from it if you want to and resell it to other people. The only stipulation for all that right and freedom that you get is that you have to pass along those very same freedoms and rights and privileges to the next person. So it creates this new commons where people can collaborate and work together in software. People can make money if they want to. They can contribute altruistically if they want to. It creates a new system of software construction. Now, this needed a legal document that defined these rights, a constitution, if you will, of the idea of software freedom. And that document's called the GNU General Public License, or GNU GPL. And I gave a whole talk just about the GPL too, but I'm not going to do that today because it's relatively dry when you get down into the details. But the interesting thing to keep in mind is the idea of share and share alike. You don't have to adopt or take in free and GPL'd software, but if you do take something GPL'd and you improve it and you distribute it to something else, so to someone else, you have to give that someone else the same rights and freedoms and privileges that you got when you got the software. So Stallman decided, once he had this license, that he was going to write, from scratch, a brand new operating system, completely written by volunteers, primarily, and some people who eventually came on staff at the Free Software Foundation, from the ground up, and release it to the world under this new license. And he did a lot of the work himself. He hired some people to do the work. But, you know, you can't write a whole operating system all by yourself, and lots of other people have contributed. And what we know today as Linux-based systems are the culmination of this work by Stallman, by his team, by others that decided to contribute to this whole software system. And by the 1990s, by the late 1990s at least, this actually was on the radar screen of Bill Gates. This was actually something that was a threat to Microsoft, at least in the server side. And that's actually around the time I started getting involved with volunteering with the Free Software Foundation. I was actually a student here, and I sort of volunteered in my spare time when I wasn't working on my thesis when I was supposed to be, you know, doing Free Software Foundation stuff. So that's why it took me so long, John, by the way. I just tried to figure that out. So eventually, when I left here, after I finally defended my thesis, I took a full-time job at the Free Software Foundation. And it was a really interesting time to take a full-time job because about 3 months after I got there, Microsoft launched this giant smear campaign against free software. They went out in the press, they got the New York Times to listen, they got a lot of big news outlets to listen, and they sent, you know, sort of executive after executive from Microsoft to come out and say how evil free software is. You know, first they said it's a cancer on the software industry. Then they said it was a virus. Then Jim Alchin, who's since been fired from Microsoft, by the way, came out and said it's un-American to do software this way. You know, so all of a sudden I'm thrown into, you know, I've never done press work before. I'm a computer geek, right? You know, so all of a sudden I'm in charge of like answering this giant press monster from Microsoft's PR firm. We did pretty well because it became a story. It actually helped us more than it hurt us in the end. And Gates wasn't really successful at this. He realized that he was a little late. If he had done that 5 years before, I think it might have been successful. Because 5 years before, people didn't know about Linux, they didn't know about all this stuff, and they would have believed it. But by that time, you know, even though the desktop wasn't really seeing a lot of free software systems on it, the server space was filled with Linux-based systems. So really, it was very easily refuted, you know, when you have Wall Street firms that do all their financial calculations on Linux boxes, which was true even in 2001, it's pretty easy to dispel these kinds of anti-free software, anti-software freedom statements from Microsoft, especially when they're so over the top as saying you're a virus and a cancer and un-American. I mean, now those arguments might work better, but in 2001, this is pre-September 11th, it wasn't so easy just to call somebody un-American and you know, yeah, dismiss them that easily. So Gates sort of waited for an opportune moment when he might be in a situation where he could, you know, he could do something about free software. And then we entered into late 2001, early 2002, and something interesting happened. Of course, there was the .com crash. The all these people who were getting money to do basically nothing and get air on chairs and pretend they're writing code and get paid, that all ended. And the remnants of it really got interested in open source and free software. They really started to realize, look, we still want this business to survive. We're one of the survivors, and we want to keep a computer business going, and we can hit the ground running by adopting open source technology. Because there's so much out there, we can add a little bit of value, and we can make a business. And really, that's when open source and free software adoption took off in the business space. And a number of companies that were proprietary software companies, we're starting to realize that there wasn't a business model in that anymore. Because if you weren't doing free software and open source and Linux, you really weren't able to be dynamic in the business environment. And one such company was called Caldera. which for a while had actually a Linux distribution that they distributed. And they had this guy, this is the most amazing name I've ever heard for a business executive, this fellow named Ransom Love. That's actually his real name. He took over Caldera and said, I'm going to make this the Linux distribution, and I'm going to proprietarize Linux and show the world how it can be and how you can have proprietary software all mixed up with Linux. And it was really kind of a big fiasco at the time. It was sort of worrying. And he went around and started buying up little pieces of dying proprietary software companies, one of them being the Santa Cruz operation, or SCO. And so he tried, and I really would like him to be the third person in my four-man story here, but the truth is that he wasn't that good of a software executive. I mean, he sort of made up for a villain, right? He sounds like a James Bond villain, you know, Ransom Love, but he ended up getting fired. He just couldn't do anything good for Caldera. So, you know, being the big Canopy Group-funded venture capital thing out in Utah, they found one of their golden boys, an MBA from Brigham Young, called Daryl McBride. And he's the third man in my epic, because he takes over Caldera and says, well, we don't have any software that's any useful. We don't have any customers anymore. Everybody's moving away from SCO, which we now own, to go to Linux. Nobody uses our Caldera distribution of Linux. So he renames the company SCO to get the historical name, and he says, I have a business plan. I know what I can do for a living. I can do patent litigation for a living. I can sue people and make tons of money just suing people. Well, so what did he do? He goes out and he says, that Linux stuff, because it's like Unix, and because SCO owns the remnants of Unix, which through a bizarre series of hand-passing, which include Novell, by the way, ends up from AT&T in the 1980s in SCO's hands. SCO ended up with the original rights of Unix. Offline, I'll tell you the whole story. It's not really that interesting. It's just businesses selling to businesses selling to businesses. But they say, okay, SCO owns the original Unix. Linux is like Unix, and we believe that Linux has appropriated, this was the word they kept using, technology from Unix. Now, appropriated is not a legal term. The only way you can get something out of Linux, or Linux could have got something out, was a couple of ways. The term intellectual property, which I don't like all that much because it makes some assumptions about the whole thing that aren't very accurate, there are basically four types of it. There are patents, there are copyrights, there are trade secrets, and there are trademarks. Well, trademark is not an issue because they have a trademark on SCO. They have a trademark on Unix. Linux didn't call itself SCO, didn't call itself Unix. Linux couldn't be violating a trademark. Trade secrets, well, the way trade secrets work is very interesting. Once a trade secret is out, it's not a trade secret anymore. And you can sue the person who released it, but only that individual is liable if they violate a trade secret thing. So maybe there was an individual who released some big trade secret about Unix. Kind of surprising. Who was it, Dennis Ritchie? I don't know. They could sue him, right, for releasing this great trade secret of how Unix worked. Turns out that might have been what they meant, because they said the malloc code got out there, but that's another story. So trade secret we wouldn't have to worry about, because if Linux had a trade secret, one person in the world was liable. So what's left? Copyrights and patents. And, you know, we at the Free Software Foundation kind of saw this might be coming, right? And we were worried, because we knew that copyrights was the dangerous place in software. And patents were pretty dangerous too, but I'll get to that in a minute. And the FSF had made this plan on how to deal with this issue. And we had collected over the years thousands upon thousands of copyright assignments from developers and attestations from all of them saying, we are contributing to this free software, but we don't know of any reason that we are, you know, appropriating any code. This is our own authorship. We're attesting to the fact that our company doesn't own this. We're an individual contributing, and we want to do it. And we want to give the copyright over to the Free Software Foundation. So for the code that was part of FSF, things were pretty good. We thought we were okay. But we were concerned about everything else in the free software world, because it hadn't had that level of pedigree, that level of attention. In fact, before SCO, free software developers used to make fun of the FSF, saying, oh, you guys, you don't know how to do free software. Do you accept copyright assignments? And that's so hard to contribute if you have to fill out paperwork to contribute. Nobody says that anymore, by the way, after the whole SCO thing happened. But we were, of course, concerned about what else was out there. And the lawsuit was scary. Who were they going to sue? We wondered. You know, are they going to sue the FSF? Are they going to sue Linus Torvalds? Who are they going to sue? Well, It's funny because the lawyer for FSF, whom I'll talk about a little bit, who I work for now, named Eben Moglen, had always been worried that we were going to get some sort of legal battle over free software. And he is very fond of saying that he had no idea that the company that decided to, quote, sue free software, unquote, would decide to sue one of the most wealthy software companies in the world that is well known for having extremely deep pockets with regard to litigation and always fights their court cases. It never settles out of court. And that's IBM. So SCO files a lawsuit against IBM. You know, as Eben Moglen tells me, he says, I had no idea. I knew it was coming, and I had no idea how I was going to get the checkbook of the big companies to defend free software. But fortunately, SCO decided to sue the biggest checkbook out there that they could. So we got access to it by default. And IBM goes off and hires Cravath, which is this very powerful law firm in New York City. And they're going to fight to the end. And actually, the funny thing is, the SCO suit's still going on. But it's all these sort of things that happen in the end of a legal case where people are just pointing fingers at each other and saying, you're mean. It really is not. It really is not anything that matters anymore. But through mid-2003 into mid-2004, it was kind of a year of hell at the Free Software Foundation. Because it was just at this moment when people were starting adopting open source and free software, and all of a sudden there's all this legal mumbo-jumbo. It's totally inaccurate. But SCO was convincing people, and they even sort of flirted with the idea of suing users of free software. You know, and so a couple companies were worried they were about to be sued by SCO. And it was really bad for the adoption of free software. And I often tell people that I think it actually set back adoption of open source and free software by at least a year, maybe two, just because people got afraid that there's some sort of legal problem. In fact, the Free Software Foundation was subpoenaed as a witness to the crime of the taking of the SCO stuff and putting it into Linux. Right? It was a kind of funny subpoena to receive. I opened it up. I was actually the person who was served the subpoena as the executive director of the foundation. And, you know, so the guy, the little messenger comes, he gives me, and he says, are you Bradley Kuhn of the Free Software Foundation? Yes, I am. You've been served. Great. Okay. So I open up the subpoena, right? And it says, we subpoena from 1992 to 2001 all emails between Richard Stallman and Linus Torvalds. All emails between Richard Stallman and any developer of GPL software. All emails ever sent regarding the GPL from the Free Software Foundation to external parties. Okay, now we're geeks, right? So we keep all our email. I mean, this is hundreds of thousands of email messages that I've just been served with a subpoena to produce. And the funny thing, you probably don't know this, I didn't know this until the organization was subpoenaed. When you get a subpoena, the only thing the lawyer who has subpoenaed you for pays for is the cost of the paper. All the time you spend getting the documents together and figuring out which documents actually are subject to the subpoena, that's your job, you don't get reimbursed for any of that. It's just the cost of the paper. It's all you get back. We bought the most expensive paper we could find. I looked at the Kinko's bill and the lawyer said to me, "Yeah, don't we need a little more services from them?" So I have an interesting sort of side. This is sort of off topic, but I think it's fun for geeks to hear. I think I'm the only person in the world to ever figure out how to answer a subpoena with a spam filter. What I did was I started taking messages from Richard Stallman's email spool and sort of putting in one box, you know, messages that mentioned the GPL or were to a GPL developer, mentioned Linus Torvalds or were to Linus Torvalds, and in the other folder I put all the other ones. So then I iteratively did it. I did about 6 months worth of that, and then I trained the spam filter. And then I ran BOGA filter against the rest of the email and started looking at how much it was right and wrong about. Then I iteratively trained it and so forth. And after a while, I was getting an incorrectly filed message every I think it was like 200 or so. And I decided, okay, every 200 or so, it's good. And I asked the lawyer, is that good enough? And he said, sure. So I think this idea of answering subpoenas with spam filters, the more and more, you know, emails getting subpoenaed might be some sort of interesting thing for law firms to try. So that was fun. So I had to take notes about this because, like, if they call you to testify on why you didn't think this document was subject to the subpoena and this one was, you have to sort of explain your method. So I have this big long paper I wrote about how to, you know, answer subpoenas with spam filters. It's kind of an interesting thing. So we printed out these five reams of paper, you know, went over to Kinko's, and it was funny because just at this point, the cracks were starting to show in this court case, right? And I'm pretty sure that all those documents just ended up in Boies's, the law firm that SCO had hired, warehouse, that, you know, David Boies just has somewhere a big room full of boxes of Richard Stallman's email. Look, I've read a lot of Richard Stallman's email. You don't want to read Richard Stallman's email. You really don't. But as I was saying before, the damage was kind of done. It really had set back the adoption of free software, and it was really unfortunate. But we were kind of never worried, and we were kind of even vindicated, as I was saying, about this whole thing that we had been worried about this, and we'd done a lot of work to try and make sure the legal infrastructure of free software was clear. And Linux, as the kernel project, had to kind of sweat it out because they had never done that work, and they accepted patches from all sorts of people, and they didn't know where they came from. So it's sort of what the first thing that inspired Eben and I to start talking about a legal organization for free software, and I'm going to talk about that towards the end of the talk. But the upshot was that SCO was only able to slow down GPL adoption. They didn't stop it. And Microsoft at one point even bought a license from SCO, quote, bought a license, unquote, which effectively meant we're giving you $2 million of our infinite money to help fund your lawsuit against free software. And Stallman's vision was sort of becoming a reality, and it was turning out that business models were starting to come into existence that worked, and people were starting to realize, hey, I can make money with open source software. And a lot of people are. You know, students are always asking me, well, how can I make money with this stuff? And I have this challenge I issue every time I talk to students. If you go out there and try to get a job working on open source software and you learn about the technology really hard, study it hard, and try to go get a job and apply to companies like Red Hat, like Ubuntu, like all these other people who do free software and open source software, I've said, if you do this, you will get a job doing open source software if it's what you want to do. And for about 7 years while I was at FSF, I was doing these talks, you know, to people, about 6 years, I guess. And I said this to many groups of students, and I say, come back to me, email me. I'm always easy to find on the net. And tell me if this doesn't work. If you can't find a job and you're forced to take a proprietary software job because it's the only one you can get in the software industry. And I think at this point, it's basically, if you want to do it, you'll be able to do it. There's really no question. And this is sort of the moment when I used to end my old talks in the old days, because this collision course between proprietary software and free software was the big thing. You know, we are on, you know, fighting proprietary to make the world better for freedom and all the sort of things. But these days, the story just kind of begins here. Because there's this fourth guy out there. The whole time, he was out there. And his name's Jack Valenti. Now, this crowd probably may not have heard of this guy. But he was, for about 30 years, the chief lobbyist for the Motion Picture Association of America to Congress. I first saw this guy on TV when I was a kid. It was right when VCRs were going to come out on the market and be available. And there were these televised hearings to Congress where Jack Valenti said that the VCR would be the death of the movie industry. It was going to be over. There were going to never be movies again. Because people would get videotapes, and they would copy movies and share them, and nobody would ever pay to see a movie again. In 1984, he goes to Congress and he says this. Now, it was kind of funny. I was Googling around right before this talk, and I found this 2003 study by a guy named Charles Weinberg. He's at the Sauder School of Business at the University of British Columbia. And he studied in 2003, like the top six, seven, something like that, blockbuster movies that were released. And he had the numbers of their profits for in-theater, DVD sale, DVD rental, VHS sale, VHS rental. If you add up the columns of DVD and VHS rental and sale, it's two times the in-theater. And this is for all the big movies and all the blockbuster movies that came out in 2003. Yeah, it was the death of the movie industry. It's now twice the revenue they can get from the theaters. Amazing, huh? It's ludicrous now even to consider that Jack Valenti thought VHS was going to kill the movie industry. It was a renaissance. People saw movies they would never have bothered gone to the theater for. They saw them on their video cassette at home. All through the 80s, all through the 90s. But this idea that cheap video availability would yield to rampant copyright infringement so much so that the Motion Picture Association couldn't make any money, it stayed with Valenti, right? So he continues to tell Congress, and his new enemy after the VCR was the digital computer. It was the thing that was going to destroy the movie industry. These days, your hard drives aren't counted in megabytes like they were when I was your age. They're counted in terabytes. I know, like, every one in five person I meet under 25 has a terabyte at home of storage. You can encode video at a rapid rate. How many people have used Handbrake in the audience? Or have heard of it at least? Okay, so what, maybe 15% of the audience, something like that? In a year, it'll be 80. I don't go to a place anymore and not meet somebody, and I talked to somebody today who told me a story, and there's a guy in my office who does the same thing, who gets a Netflix subscription. They take the disc, they put it in the thing, they run Handbrake, they encode it, they send the disc back, and they do this all day, every day. They're just encoding movies and putting them on their thing. We have displays now, LCD screens and projector screens that can play movies. I know people, 25 and under mostly, who don't own a TV, not because they don't watch TV, mind you. It's because they just torrent every TV show they want to watch. The whole analog mode of distributing information is outdated. The idea of the printing press, which, by the way, was invented in 1450, right, and it's basically been the same model, although the media changed, you know, because we got video and we got audio and we got everything else. But the idea that you print a bunch of stuff onto a DVD, onto a CD, onto a book, or paper, dead tree, and you ship it to a store and you market to a bunch of people to convince them to buy it, and then you try to get them to buy it, and that's how you do distribution of content, as it were. The age is over because the need for the physical copy has ended, because most people in the industrialized world have enough hard drive space, have enough display power, have enough CPU power to just watch what they want to watch and listen to what they want to listen to and read what they want to read on their computer. So there's really no limit to what the bit stream represents anymore. Any information that people and humans want to communicate to each other can be represented pretty straightforwardly in a bit stream. So Jack Valenti, who called the VCR the Boston Strangler of the movie industry in the 1980s, was, and if that, he was scared of that, he's mortified by the digital computer. The industry scrambled. In 2000, we passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is one of the worst copyright laws we've passed up to this day, and they've all been pretty bad. Made it a felony to circumvent the copyright protection on any media you get. You're committing a felony most of the time if you encode your DVDs. A felony. Isn't that bizarre? Copyright infringement is a felony, a criminal felony? Up to that point, up until the DMCA, when you violated copyright law, it was a civil offense. You could be fined. You could have to pay the company money, recompense. It's a felony when you circumvent the copy protection on the DVDs using something like libDVD CSS from France, which is what Handbrake uses. So, I don't know. Maybe you should be afraid to use Handbrake. I don't know. I have it on my laptop, so I'm not that scared. The idea of digital restrictions management a couple years later after DMCA came into play. See, what they wanted to do was, they have, the motion picture people have funny terms. They call it the analog hole. And what the analog hole is that at some point, a digital stream of information has to become analog for you to, you know, it has to be letters that you can read or sound that your eardrum can pick up or scenes that your eyeballs can see. So at some point they know, well, it has to be, we can't just plug it into their brains. So we have to get it through their analog holes and get the information to them. But what they need from the digital stream all the way up until the last analog moment, they need this leak-proof pipe. Because if there's a leak anywhere, you have a hole, you have a way to siphon off that digital stream and save it and watch it again. Because that's the worst thing. If you can watch a movie twice and only pay for it once, well, Jack Valenti would say, that would be the death of the MPAA and the whole movie industry. Now, I go off on this thing about how crazy copyright is, not because we in the free software world think copyright shouldn't be there. In fact, I told you before, we use copyright as a way, as a mechanism to defend freedom. It's not that we're opposed to copyright unilaterally. We have some questions, some really big debates about what copyright should be, but we're not necessarily opposed to it. And we don't want people to infringe copyright. I don't think people should infringe copyright. In fact, in the free software world, if you infringe copyright, you're violating the GPL and you're taking away rights from people, in our view. And we always wanted our free software to be legally clear, original authorship, written from scratch, in a community sort of way, in a way that no one could ever question the integrity of, that SCOs could come along and try, but they would fail. And we wanted it that way. So we didn't have a beef with copyright. We weren't at war with copyright. But the strange thing that happened is we were at such odds with these demands from the MPAA, the RIAA, people who produce this kind of stuff. It's because when you have a system that's free software, you can't build that leak-proof pipe. Because even if I build a perfectly DRM'd end-to-end system in free software, well, free software says I have to give you the source code, and you just take it out, you put in your own little analog hole, and you siphon off that bit stream. So suddenly, we found ourselves, because of DRM, at total odds with the movie industry. It was kind of surprising, actually, that the movie industry ends up being the bigger enemy of free software than even the proprietary software companies, who, by the way, are starting to adopt free software more and more. They're changing their business models. The MPAA, by contrast, refuses. They will not change their business model. They will not reconsider how the system should work in the age of the digital computer. Instead, they're insisting that we have technologies that stop people from copying and from sharing and everything else. You know, the Zune, which is Microsoft's answer to the iPod, came out about four months ago. And has this thing, which is the most disgusting word for sharing a file I've ever heard. You can squirt your music to someone else. This is their terminology. Isn't this bizarre? So, but you can only squirt twice. Because once you squirt twice, the DRM kicks in and you can't squirt anymore. Now, and in the same web page where they explain about the squirting of the Zune, they tell you, oh, by the way, this is a great way for musicians who are trying to get started to share their music. Because if you have a Zune and you're on the subway, or well, I guess I'm in Cincinnati, no subway. If you're walking down the street, I guess you guys don't walk down the street either. Well, if you're in your car and somebody happens to be at the red light with you, you can type into your Zune, and you can squirt the file over to them, and they can choose to accept or reject. So if you're a musician, you can go around squirting your music. Now, how annoying would it be, right? So you're a big musician, you're like, I want to get well known, I'm going to use my Zune, go around, squirt my files at people, and they'll hear my music and like it. But then they really like it, and then they decide to share it with their friends, and there's no way on the Zune to tell it, you know, I want this file to be infinitely squirtable, or whatever you might say. It can only be squirted twice. So they like it. They're like, oh, this is great. I want to give this to my friend. And they send it over to their friend. And the friend gets it and says, I really like it. I want to, well, it's the last squirt, right? It's like, oh, well, you know, I can hear it, and I can't let anybody else hear it. So it's just this idea that they admit that these new technologies, and I actually think that's a good idea. You know, the whole idea of file sharing is a great way, and it's helped out a lot of bands, putting their stuff up on the internet, making it available. But in the same breath that they're saying, this is a great thing for bands to do and a new model for the industry, we're also going to add this DRM stuff that stops you from sharing. It stops even when you want people to be allowed to share it. And the iPad doesn't work that much different. I don't care what. And people keep saying, well, Jobs said he's against DRM, but he's not really. It's in the iPod. It's there. It's in iTunes. It's there. DRM is in all of the proprietary software stuff. So we're in a kind of weird situation, though, because on the long term, proprietary software on small devices can't survive. And here's why. The devices are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to make. And we have just about passed the point where you're paying more for the software license for the software that you put on the little electronic device than you are for the device itself, as far as a manufacturing point of view. If you can manufacture an audio player, video player, handheld for, say, $15 a unit, and you have to pay $18 a unit for the software license, does that make any sense at all? That you're paying more for the software on the thing? So they need our stuff, right? They need Rockbox, which is a free firmware for most audio players, works on most iPods and iRiver and other types of stuff like that. They need that stuff that people in the community are just making better because they like it, and they can adopt it and distribute it under GPL, and they can make money from it, but they don't have to pay the upfront licensing proprietary software cost. So they're going to need our stuff, yet our stuff can't be DRM'd. So what are they going to do? Well, it's more about legal threats, right? The very nature of this free software thing is the enemy of the MPAA, of the RIAA. So they're going to have to put forward legal threats to free software. And I think the next go is coming from somewhere there. It's coming from a Disney. It's coming from that side of the house, not from the Microsofts and so forth. It's coming from the people who produce this beautiful, quote-unquote, content that they deign to let us see and hear if we can get past and be at the end of the analog hole and be able to see it. So this legal suspicion, this legal threat, is very dangerous. And it's kind of the most powerful threat to free software because of the way we operate. We're collaborative. We contribute code on the internet. We email patches. We accept patches from people who just give us a couple of lines because they had 5 minutes to fix a bug that they found. And it's hard to get those copyright assignments. I did it at FSF for many years, going around collecting copyright assignments from developers and making sure all the code was clean. It's not possible in every project, and it's difficult. So because this was kind of the Achilles heel of free software, and because FSF is a small organization that only really services its specific GNU project, we sort of decided we had to do something different. So we started this thing called the Software Freedom Law Center, which is where I work now. And the whole purpose of it is to provide these kinds of legal services to free software, because the threats are there, and they're coming more and more. We need to make sure the infrastructure is legally safe and legally certain. And the other thing that we're doing through the other thing that David mentioned in my introduction, the Software Freedom Conservancy, is giving administrative services to these projects, because free software contributors are really good at making really awesome software, but they're not good at being on boards of directors and being in charge of nonprofit organizations. So what the Conservancy does is it creates a shell, a nonprofit 501c3 in the U.S. shell, that allows people to join up as a software project, receive donations, tax deductible in the U.S., and get that for their project, and we do the administrative work of sort of running the details. And doing their license enforcement and helping them with the legal issues. So that's what we're trying to do. And I'm happy to talk more about that. I think it's kind of boring to sort of get up here and just say, this is what my organization does and go off about that. So I don't want to spend too much time talking about that. And I want to open it up for questions in a minute. But I want to close by saying I actually think this is a really amazing time to be involved in computer science and computer technology in general. This idea of ubiquitous, high bandwidth computer networking combined with the mass market access to digital storage, this is changing the way we live. And I think the principles of the software freedom stuff that I've been involved with for the last decade or so is part of the reshaping of how we think about what legal and political systems ought to exist for things that are represented as bit streams. All of these legal mechanisms, the patents, the copyrights, the trademarks, the trade secrets, they were invented by and large in the age of the printing press, hundreds of years ago. They've been refined over the years, but they're basically old legal technology. They are the Fortran of legal code. Sorry if I offend any Fortran programmers. And what I think we need to do is reconsider this stuff. We, just like the printing press sort of took us out of the dark ages historically into the Enlightenment, we have to do the same thing with digital technology. It's just as revolutionary. It really is. The idea that you can carry in your hand a thing that can do movies and music and show you all this stuff, and you can share it with people, that's changing the world. And I think it's a wonderful time to be involved. Everything can be a bitstream now, and we have to think about what that means for our society. And that's really what I want to impart to you guys and get you thinking about. So that's about all I have to say as far as a formal talk. I want to open up to questions and hear what you all have to say. Yeah, Tom.
Really, just more of a comment. I wondered if you might add Lawrence Lessig to your list of folks. One of the things I got from his writing on copyright is how we've been basically disenfranchised from this public domain stuff that's really a part of our legacy. That process you just described of having to document every line of code to show that it was free and the copyrights were clear. Now, if I want to do a presentation on the 60s, all this content that would have been in the public domain, I have to do the same thing. And that part doesn't happen anymore because basically I create this thing. Someone can come back with a claim and, you know, bust up the project and sue me.
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. I mean, this is what relates back to Jack Valenti and the MPAA, frankly, and that's what Lessig is commenting on. I agree with you. You know, I can't mention everybody, but Larry is a really important guy in this whole picture. And he was inspired originally by Stallman. You know, he saw what Stallman was doing in the free software movement and tried to start to look at how it applied to other types of things. And it's really interesting. I mean, I'm going to go through this because I know Tom knows it, but I want to make sure the audience understands. The copyright system, as it exists, is this deal we made as a society with people who produce copyrightable content. Our Constitution in the United States says Congress shall have the power to create a copyright system should it deem that it will promote the advancement of science and the useful arts. So it wasn't that the copyright system was mandatory in our founding documents. It was an option. Should our Congress decide that it would advance things, that it would get things going? It was this idea that, well, okay, so people need a limited time monopoly on the reproduction rights of their work to recoup their costs for creating it. It wasn't designed for what it's being used today, and it was designed to be temporary, a temporary monopoly on the reproduction rights of your work. Our original copyright, when it came into existence, in, I think it was 1796, was for 5 years. It was extended in 1812 to, I think, 8 years renewable to 12. And the funny thing was, so this is just a side note, the original copyright law specifically said that they would not respect the copyrights of the United Kingdom. Of course, because the copyrights of the United Kingdom were held by the Crown, and of course we hated the Crown. We just fought a Revolutionary War against them. It's really interesting to note that because we're so into the WIPO thing, right? WIPO is this World Intellectual Property Organization which tries to enforce U.S. copyrights around the world, right? But there was a time in our history where we weren't the big superpower, and we said, well, you know, we don't like this big superpower's copyrights, and we're not going to respect them, which is what China's saying us to today, and yet we're angry at China. Kind of interesting. But this copyright system was short. It was designed to be a short-term thing to recoup your cost. And what's happened is we're living in a generation right now that may never see the public domain again. The idea was to get the person to regenerate the copyrighted work, get him paid, and then get the thing into public domain as quickly as possible. That's not what happens now. We don't have temporary copyright like we were supposed to. We have perpetual copyright on the installment plan. What happens is every time the copyright on Steamboat Willie, the original Mickey Mouse movie that Disney produced, is about to expire, Disney convinces Congress to extend copyright another 8 to 12 years. And this has been happening since 1956. Those of you who are actually my age, if you're in your 30s right now, nothing in your lifetime that was produced was ever falling into the public domain in your lifetime. There will be no public domain. The idea was that we'd have this public thing which you could then generate new copyrighted works from, and then generate new things which would be copyrighted for a short term, and then you do it again, and this culture feeds on itself. And if you're interested in this particular part of the topic, I agree with Tom, you should go read Larry Lessig's books, because he really talks a lot about this issue. So it's really important, this idea. And the Motion Picture Association is the thing that's driving this. This idea of perpetual copyright. So I think it's a really interesting point, and I appreciate it. Robert, go ahead.
I had a question for you about Microsoft's Longhorn, which has now become Vista. And I don't know how much people in here have read, if anyone's read Peter Gutman's paper on Vista, but Vista has been engineered from the ground up for total ownership of the machine by Microsoft, and including the dictates of hardware designs have to be approved by the MPAA. I'm not going to go into this, but perhaps you could summarize that. And I'd like to know what you think of the impact of Windows Vista on the free software movement.
Well, I'll start in the beginning with what you asked, and I want to make sure the recording gets everything. And since you're not mic'd, the question is basically about Vista and this issue that Vista is designed to make DRM ubiquitous on personal computers. It has this thing called the signed driver system, and you have to have the drivers signed. There are rumors. I don't think they're necessarily confirmed that the MPAA approves the drivers. But certainly, Microsoft can decide when you're allowed to use a particular device on your computer. And if you sign up for the update service from Microsoft, which everybody has to because you otherwise don't get security updates for your computer, they're also going to decide when you can't use your DVD drive anymore because, oh my gosh, the MPAA has discovered that you can use that DVD drive to save movies that you can then share on BitTorrent. So Microsoft Vista is actually not an upgrade, per se. It's a system designed to get DRM in everybody's hands and make sure that every device you're using is DRM'd. It's very, very frightening. Now, the funny thing is I don't think free software has to worry too much because I don't think Microsoft is that much of a threat anymore because already you're seeing reports everywhere that people are upgrading to Vista and things don't work. There was this big story last week that if you're running the Citrix client, which is what people use to look at remote desktops of Windows, it doesn't work under Vista. Why? Because, well, it doesn't have a signed driver for whatever it needs to do. Right? So I'm not too worried. I'm generally worried about the issue of MPAA and movie studios teaming up with Microsoft. We're basically pretty fortunate that they hate each other most of the time. Now, if they ever really get on the same page, I mean really get on the same page, then we're in trouble. I don't think they're there yet. Vista is very, very scary, and I'm very concerned about it, but I encourage, if you're already a Windows user, just don't upgrade, just refuse, because it's not an upgrade. It's not worth it. But I think it might be too little too late. I'm hoping, at least, that it's too little too late, because I think that this other issue that I was talking about how these small devices, they aren't going to be able to run proprietary software forever because it's just too expensive. They're going to have to put free stuff on those devices, and that free stuff is not going to have DRM in it. And people are going to want to use those devices. So I think the public is going to get an idea about how much a problem DRM is. I think we're right on that cusp, and I think we'll be okay. But it's certainly scary, and it's certainly worth mentioning, and worth talking about how bad it is. Yeah, back there. Well, it's going to be one or the other, right? It's going to be sort of kill DRM, or it's going to make DRM succeed. I think it's more likely to kill DRM. I think you're right. I think that people are going to start to realize. But we really have to get to that moment where the consumer electronics are all free software. And we're close. Because if you go to Japan right now, and you go to Tokyo and you find every electronic device imaginable that they just haven't put on the market here. And they're all running Linux-based stuff. They don't bother to make the license for the proprietary stuff on them. And as they get adopted across Asia, which will happen, and they get adopted across China, which will happen, people around the world are not going to put up with it. The U.S. may sort of be this sort of like DRM lockdown country. That could happen. But I think the rest of the world is just not going to put up with it. The rest of the world doesn't want to run Windows. The rest of the world's sick of running Windows and sick of having the Business Software Alliance, which is the Microsoft sort of enforcement agent for their licenses, banging on their doors, you know, shutting down companies in India, shutting down companies in China because they've got copyright infringing copies of Microsoft Windows. They're all going to switch to free software. So it might be really bad for the U.S. coming up, but I think around the world it's actually going to be pretty good. I should mention one big thing that I tell people a lot is most of the people in the world haven't picked what operating system they run. It's really important to think about that. We live in the industrialized world, you know, in the U.S., in Europe, we're used to, you know, everybody sort of having succumbed to Microsoft. But there's a lot more people in rural India, in rural China, in Africa, who haven't seen a computer yet. Half of them don't have electricity. And there's this project that's really interesting to take a look at, and I'm out of MIT, called the One Laptop Per Child Project. It's also called the $100 Laptop Project. It's 100% free software. It has a hand crank on the side that allows somebody who's in Africa who doesn't have electricity to crank for 10 minutes and they get 30 minutes of power. At least that's what they're targeting for. The thing has wireless mesh technology, so if you've got a community that has lots of people, it all connects up and you can see who else is in your community. The top of it lifts off. A friend of mine that actually works for the project, he showed me. The top of it lifts off and you can see how it all works inside. Even the hardware is open and free in that way. It's really an amazing project, and it's based on Ubuntu Linux. And these kids are going to pick their operating system, and they're going to pick the thing that they got when they were 8 years old in school, because their government bought it from MIT at $100 a piece. It's really going to change around the world. I don't know what's going to happen in the U.S., but around the world, they're going to be free software. More questions? What else? Over here.
Actually, just a comment on the Vista thing. Mm-hmm. Apple released recently, I don't know if it's quite related, it's somewhat related to it, it isn't specifically with DRM, but where they had one guy, the guy who was a PC, kept asking questions over and over again before anybody could use something. So I think there may already be sort of customer awareness, at least through that commercial.
It's a strange commercial, I've seen the commercial as well, and it's very interesting to me because Apple is as pro-DRM as Microsoft is, particularly on the iPod architecture. And it's very strange that they're using, you know, it's the typical, you know, a buddy of mine at work, a lawyer, calls me the psycho-historian of the free software movement. So forgive me if I'm being too psycho-historical, but this is about Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. It's about the way they think and the way they think about each other. And it's this weird thing where they're more alike than they are different, but they believe somehow they're different. The guy who's really different is Stallman, right? He's totally, you know, this guy out there trying to make freedom, but they're about locking people down. Jobs would like to tell you, I'm about freeing people, I'm about letting people express themselves, but no, he's not. He's about locking people down, just like Gates is, just in a different way. So it's really an ironic sort of thing, and I think people hopefully will start to realize that the Mac's not really any more free than the Windows system. It's true that the Mac is based somewhat on free software, But it's based on BSD, and it's proprietorized, and it's a little less free than the other stuff you find out there and things like Ubuntu. Glad you wanted to follow up.
That was actually a question that I was sort of asking on less free. Mm-hmm. I was curious what you thought about the Creative Commons license that Lessig had come up with, where instead of it being directly, you know, free and open, it allowed varying degrees of latitude depending upon the license.
Well, yeah, as you point out, Creative Commons isn't just one license, it's a host of licenses. And the goal that Creative Commons is trying to do, which is a really interesting and good goal, is they're trying to design, as Tom mentioned a few minutes ago, a set of licenses for other types of work. Creative Commons is really, and Lessig would say this himself, inspired by what we did in the free software movement. The GPL, which actually Creative Commons, if you look at their website, they say the only software license we recommend is GPL. But the way copyright works is that it's this blunt instrument for dozens and dozens of types of works. And this is, again, back to this age of the printing press thing where, you know, we only used to have one type of works. It was the book, and that's what we designed copyright for. But it's been shoehorned and applied to all these other things. So what we've done in the free software world is said, this is how we think copyright ought to function for software. We have some ideas about that. But what Lessig is doing is he's trying to look at the broader picture and say, how should copyright be applied to movies? And should it be the same or different than software? Well, probably different. How should it be different? And how should it be applied to music? And Creative Commons, the whole licensing structure they've invented, is an experiment of trying to encourage people to find what licenses work for them for other types of work, non-software works. Because we shouldn't be using copyright as a blunt instrument that just says, apply copyright the same way to every type of work. We should be doing it differently for different types of works, and that's what Creative Commons is experimenting with. I think it's great. We don't really know as a culture. We've spent like 20 years thinking about free software and how software ought to be using the copyright system. But it hasn't been done as long for these other types of works. And it's going to take time for us to figure out what, culturally, what's the right type of license for a movie? What's the right type of license to give people freedom but still make sure the guy gets paid and all the other stuff for other types of works? I'll just sort of start heading this way across the room.
Yeah. What do you think about other licenses like the MIT license or the Berkeley license?
Well, there's, you know, I used to have a stronger position on this when I worked for the FSF than I do now. One of the things we did when we started the Software Freedom Law Center is we're, you know, open-minded to anything that's free software. Anything that gives you those freedoms, the right to copy, share, modify, and redistribute, like the FreeBSD license does, for example. You know, actually, you know, one of the BSD projects is a client of ours. I won't say which one. But we are open-minded to that and where I am now. I mean, I think, personally, I think that GPL does better, and LGPL, which is sort of a sister license, is a little less, you know, sort of controlling of what you can and can't do with the code as far as incorporating into proprietary works. I think those licenses are better because they require someone, if they want to join the club, they have to contribute back. One of the worries when people started writing free software was that proprietary stuff would just pick it up and then jump ahead all the time because it would be proprietary having a couple extra features and you couldn't get the code back. So I think it's a trade-off, and I think there's a place for all types of different software licenses, and they do different things, and they serve different goals. And I think when you look at a software project, you have to decide what your goal is as far as, you know, what do you want users to do, and do you want certain freedoms to be protected or not, or does it matter too much to you? And that's sort of a question for each person who writes software to decide. I'm just going to keep going across the room with the questions. In this area, I saw a couple hands up, so yeah, go ahead.
Or Microsoft should have done differently when considering DRM because, like, looking back on it, to rapidly create the iPod, they had to get permissions from, you know, everywhere, all the music industries, like, I want to put your music on my iPod. The only way to do that, they weren't going to allow MP3s. I mean, like, MP3.com was shut down. Look at that when you can put a CD in there.
Well,
so, like, how do you get past that?
Interesting question, right? I agree with your statement if you replace the word iPod with iTunes, because they couldn't have made the iTunes store without that kind of cooperation. Could they have made the iPod? I think so. I think the iPod would have gotten wide adoption as an MP3 player because MP3.com went away, but BitTorrent started right after, and people are sharing music across BitTorrent. It's copyright infringement, of course it is, but people are doing it anyway. It's this interesting thing about this whole issue because the copyright law exists for the people, right? In this country, we have a government for the people, by the people. And the copyright law is for us. And if the people are overwhelmingly saying, we want to share files, which they are, shouldn't we be reconsidering this stuff? Shouldn't we be saying, to our legislature, we don't want copyright law. Well, unfortunately, we can't because lobbyists control Congress, and lobbyists for the MPAA are a lot richer than lobbyists for us. That's an unfortunate political problem. But I sort of say when you have that political system, the civil disobedience of sharing files is reasonable. And I think that Apple could have gotten away, not with the iTunes Store, but with iPod, and been successful. I don't know what their revenue base looks like. I don't know how. It may be the case, and this could really be true, that they lose money on the iPod and make it back on iTunes Store. That might be true. I don't know, in which case they've got a problem as far as their funding model. But given that there's other players out there and there's other companies making money, it's probably not true. They probably could have lived without the iTunes Store selling songs. But there's another thing I want to say about the iTunes Store, which is really interesting, that do you really think it's the case if people are willing to pay 90 cents for a song that's DRM'd, wouldn't they pay 90 cents for the MP3 just to save themselves the trouble of go finding it on a torrent? I certainly would. I'll tell you a personal story. I'm a big fan of This American Life, and Ira Glass has been a real jerk about this whole DRM thing. So if you want to get This American Life, if you don't get it in the week when the podcast is available as an MP3, you have to go to audible.com and get it. Well, it's in a format that free software players won't play. And I missed one, and I was desperately trying to get it. And my price kept going up in my head. I kept saying, if I could get an MP3 file for a dollar, I'd pay it right now. And I was spending more time trying to find it. I was like, if I could pay $5 right now to get this one damn This American Life show I missed, I'll pay $5. My price got up to $20 before I gave up, and I circumvented his DRM. You know, but there was a moment when I was going to hand Ira $10 for an MP3 file, just for the convenience. I think people would pay for MP3 files. I think people want to pay when the price is reasonable. I don't think people generally want to do file sharing. They're doing it because the restrictions are there, and it's difficult to do what they want to do with their music, with their movies, with their podcasts, with their radio shows. And I think this is where this debate that we're having, we have to have more, and we have to have it with the content producers. And unfortunately, there's not a venue for it. Yeah, I want to get he has his hand up for a while there.
Like all things in life, like you just mentioned, 90 cents right now is a reasonable price most people are willing to pay. But like everything, the price is going to go up. What, I guess, how far do you think the record industry and everyone can push before if people do break and literally jump ship for Linux or wherever else where they don't have to deal with it?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't know where the breaking point is. It's hard to know. I think it's an interesting, this is why I say it's an exciting time, because I don't know when it's all going to break. And I think we have a lot of stuff to do in the free software world to get people to adopt. We have an obligation to make things easier for people to do, and I think the Ubuntu guys are doing a great job in this regard, making it easier to install free software so that, you know, it's not so hard anymore. So I think it's, we just got to watch and wait. I don't know for sure. Yeah.
Can we do a poll?
What poll do you want to do? Robert wants to do a poll.
Everybody who's bought an iTunes music, an iTunes song, raise their hand.
He wants to know how many people have bought iTunes. That's interesting. More than I thought.
Okay.
And all that, look, he asked how many people circumvented the DRM after they bought that, and all the hands basically stayed up. A few didn't go down.
Okay, now, how many people would buy an MP3 from the iTunes store?
It's more hands than the iTunes. It's a good point, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting. Hey, you had a question. Go ahead.
Largest retailer of online music, despite not having any major record labels.
I've heard that too.
And they charge a very low fee compared to iTunes.
Right.
And it's all just MP3.
Yeah, and it's an amazing example. eMusic is an amazing example. I'd forgotten about it, and I'm glad you reminded me. You know, eMusic is this interesting thing where it's not major labels. It's artists who have decided to adopt the business model of selling their files in a freely redistributable format, and hoping that it produces, you know, interest in the band. And it's working. It is working. Because the major labels, generally they produce crap these days. It's the truth. I mean, at least I think. I'm an old guy now, so I'm like, you know, if it's not, you know, punk from the 80s, I'm not interested. But, you know, I still listen to Dead Kennedys albums. I mean, what can I say? I'm sort of trying to go across the thing. I know you're all waiting over there, but go ahead.
I just want to make a comment to say how it really shows how powerful the MPAA is when Microsoft has all this DRM stuff in it. Because if you think about it, Microsoft really doesn't have to put DRM into Windows Vista was the MPAA really sort of pushed them.
Yeah, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories about how much, you know, Microsoft is in bed with the MPAA regarding DRM. I'm not sure if I believe all of it yet. It's not clear to me. I know the history of Microsoft, and historically Microsoft has been very opposed to MPAA, just for other reasons, totally unrelated, because, you know, Bill Gates had this view of what the future of television would be, and it was supposed to be a Microsoft box, and this is all through the 90s. They had this big argument, and so I'm not clear that they've just made up and now have decided. I don't know. I mean, it could be that they want this because they want to control, you know, their own stuff, right? They want to proprietize their own stuff. That could be part of it too. So I think it's one of these complicated forces, and to think that, well, the MPA ordered Microsoft to do it and they're powerful, it's more complex than that. I'm sure that the issues about file sharing were involved in deciding how Vista came out, but I don't think it was as simple as, you know, Jack Valenti, well, he's retired now, but Jack Valenti's replacement showed up and said, you will do this or I will bury you or something. I don't think that's how it came down. But it is an issue. This is important, these relationships, and we have to watch them carefully. I want to keep moving this way, so yeah, let me start down here. I know you've been waiting for a while.
Do you think there's a rising threat to freedoms with regards to hardware modifications? You hear a lot of news about, you know, people doing like mod chips for Xboxes and whatnot. And there's been cases of people being sued for that. A lot of the time, they were doing other stuff like pirating,
Right.
Do you think there's a danger to consumer freedoms from that front, similar to DRM and software?
Yeah. It goes back to this leak-proof pipe thing, right? Because so the pipe doesn't just go through the software; it goes all the way down to the hardware. So yeah, if you don't have DRM's hardware, DRM software is sort of meaningless, you know, because you could just circumvent it through the hardware. And you could make an analog hole by, you know, just wiring it up or something like that. And there was a really big scare that there was going to be widespread DRM hardware in the whole trusted computing thing that was happening a couple of years ago. And by and large, it turned out like the processor ID thing, which happened, you know, 5 years before that, it just people weren't willing to adopt it. They weren't willing to have the idea that their computer was completely locked down at the hardware level from them. So it is a threat because it is part of the whole strategy. It has to be locked down on the hardware and the software too. But it's all sort of the same picture, right? I mean, if the software is not locked down, it's going to be really hard for the hardware to be locked down. If the hardware is locked down, it's hard for the software. So it's almost the same issue, basically, I would say. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I have a website, company, and where you sort of standardize on Joomla.
Mm-hmm. Joomla is a client of ours, by the way. Joomla is a client of ours, by the way.
Well, Creative Commons, we really make our money in developing the content,
mm-hmm,
and the search engine optimization,
mm-hmm,
for the site's working and allowing that. So I was just wondering if you could comment on the web applications like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the major adoption areas for free software was web applications. And there are people really worried about what it means for the future of free software, right? Because while you're saying, well, you're not making money on the software modifications, they're not really doing a lot of that, you're doing more of the content side of it, there are people that are building applications that are completely web-based that they're trying to get wide adoption for, you know, companies like Google, for example. And this idea that software is going to become a thing you can only get to on the computer from the network through, of all things, Ajax, which is just horrible. This idea that that's what software is going to become is a dangerous one, because the GPL, at least in version 2, doesn't really apply if you're just servicing someone with the software, right? So if you're running a GPL software on a web server and somebody comes and uses your website, you don't have to give them the source code under GPL version 2, unless you want to. And as things like Google Apps become more common, it's this idea that you don't actually have a computer anymore. You have a network connection device, and all your software lives on somebody else's server. I think this is really dangerous because it changes the way people think about software, and you don't have your own software anymore, which I think is really bad for the future of computing in general. I think people should have their own software and have the right to their own software. And it's dangerous. The other part of it, I think, is it's crazy to put your data on somebody else's server and say, here, Google, have all my spreadsheets for my business. Here, Google, have every legal document I've ever produced. Use your great search engine technology on my stuff. Yeah, and put it into your data mining system. Yeah, that's what I really want about all my personal files. I certainly don't, you know. So I hope you guys won't either. But that's a real issue with the web services thing. But I think generally the idea of building websites with free software is a hugely important thing, and it's a big thing about free software adoption. I want to get, Tom, I want to make sure nobody else has any questions before I go for second timers. Does anybody else have anything, or do we hear from Tom again? All right, go ahead.
You can briefly explain a copyright law in other countries, for instance, with the All of MP3 case in Russia, where the recording industry tried to sue some company for like more than the GDP of Russia.
All right, well, this is the point in the talk where I have to remind you, because I work for a law firm, I'm not actually a lawyer, so I can't give you legal advice, and I can't give you official legal theory. I can give you my layperson's understanding of what the way the copyright system works. What's happened with U.S. copyright law, because the U.S. is so powerful and because things like WIPO exist, we've more or less exported U.S. copyright and, to some extent, U.S. patent law to other countries. What happened with copyright law is there's this thing called the Berne Convention on Copyright. I believe it was in 1976 or sometime in the late 70s. And what that did was basically say that if a copyright system in any country requires a certain thing or has a certain thing or does a certain thing, it's automatically exported to every other country that signed the Berne Convention, which is basically every, you know, major country in the world signed Berne. So because of that, right, they can go into any place, you know, any country that signed Berne and say, we're going to sue you for damages on U.S. rates, which are huge because the statutory damages are really big in U.S. copyright law. It's basically $2,000 per infringing act, which, and an infringing act is like making one copy. So if you make, like, you know, a lot of copies, suddenly it's huge, right? So that's what basically happened. And it's silly, right? I mean, I told that story about the fact that the early U.S. copyright law explicitly said that it didn't want to respect United Kingdom copyrights. You know, and now we're in the situation of the United Kingdom trying to impose our copyright law on other countries because we're the big superpower now. You know, we're the empire, so we're the ones going out doing that. So I think it's very unfortunate that other countries are willing to accept that. I wish they'd fight it more, but they don't have a lot of power because it's up against the empire. What can you do? So any other hands before I go back to Tom? He's a second timer too. I should have went to Tom first, but go ahead.
Just a comment to add to that. Some of it does depend, though, upon how the other countries who sign those treaties enforce it. Because, like, for instance, with China and Japan, like, Japan, as Leslie talked about in one of his books, has this whole market of, like, fanfic type derivative works of copyright that all the companies allow. They're in comic form called doujinshi, and it actually, the companies look the other way. And I think maybe the real issue is not that the other countries have the copyright law, it's how do they enforce the copyright law.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. The question of selective enforcement, you know, of the things that get exported by Berne are a question. And I think that's, I mean, and of course, it's interesting that this has become the top diplomatic priority for the U.S. in most Asian countries. Their top priority is enforcement of U.S. copyright and patent law in these other countries. It's a very sort of lopsided thing that this is suddenly the thing that matters more than anything else in the world to the United States. And that's what it's about, because they're saying you have to enforce it. And it's become this huge diplomatic priority because of pressure from the Motion Picture Association primarily and from the RIA to some point. And it's really a weird thing that we've decided this is what matters to us. I mean, I'm going to get a little too liberal here, but the idea of the cultural imperialism of it really bothers me. The idea that our movies are so important that, you know, that the copyrights on our movies must be respected across all of Asia because they're so important and they matter so much and all their dollars should come back for their entertainment back to the United States. It's the same thing's true with Microsoft too, right? It's like the IT industry of China does not want to siphon off, you know, 15, 20, 30% of its budget to pay Microsoft off. That's not right. They should have their own IT industry. I mean, imagine if in this country we were paying 15 to 20% of all our IT budgets to some company in France. How do you think people would feel about that? I mean, we wouldn't be that happy about it. You know, we want to pay it to an American company. The reason we're willing to do it is because Microsoft happens to be an American company and Bill Gates is somehow some sort of American hero for some weird reason. But because he's rich. Oh, great. Big deal. I don't like rich people very much. Go ahead, Tom.
Quick follow-up on that. I was wondering if maybe there's an anime version or hentai version of Steamboat Willie.
It's a good question. I don't know.
What I wanted to ask you is, what are you having in Zajax?
You know, I actually managed an AJAX project recently. If you go to gplv3.fsep.org, the gplv3 comment process was all an AJAX project, and I managed the guy who wrote that. I was amazed at the level of how far behind the technology is. I mean, I felt like we were working on software in 1994, because there were no debuggers that were any good. There was no standardization across platforms. So we got it working great in Firefox and didn't work in Internet Explorer. And then we said, well, we don't care about Internet Explorer. But then Stallman, of all people, Stallman said he wanted to make sure people in Internet Explorer could still comment on the GPL. So suddenly, you know, and the weird thing, because Stallman asked for something, I have to get a Windows box. That was a weird moment in my life. And so we got a Windows box and we got it working in Internet Explorer. And then it broke in Conqueror, you know, which is another free software browser. And Stallman got upset because he said, well, Conqueror is a GPL browser. It has to work. And so we're just jumping through hoops to make this thing work. And then we discovered that the CPU on the local machine was a huge variable, right? Because when you start doing AJAX, a lot of the processing gets loaded down to the local machine, and you don't know what it's going to be like. And we noticed, in particular, on Internet Explorer Windows machines, that it just ran so slow that people thought the site was down. And so we had to add this little message that said, we're loading your comments right now that you searched for, and you may see this message even though you don't need to because you're on Firefox, and it's going to go away real soon, but it's still going to be there if you're on Internet Explorer, maybe, and maybe on Conqueror too, and we don't know. JavaScript is not an environment for really good application development. The browser wasn't supposed to be an application delivery platform, and I think it's showing that. I know AJAX is this big buzzword, and everybody's like, well, it's a new buzzword, so we get excited about it, but I think it's really dangerous and complicated because it's sort of taking steps backwards. I'm not saying I have a better solution to deliver stuff that way, but it feels like the old browser wars of doesn't work in Netscape Navigator but works in Internet Explorer. You need Internet Explorer version 6 or later to use this site. I mean, what is this, 1996? Yeah, go ahead. We're going around to second questions.
Google has really gotten too big and too powerful. Is there any alternative for searching the Internet?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think it is dangerous. I think that it's one of these cases where one company got a little too powerful too quickly. And despite the motto, I think there is an opportunity for Google to do some real evil if they're not careful. And I don't have an answer for what we should do about it. I mean, the interesting thing about Google is they're effectively an open source and free software company. Like, what do you think that server is when you connect to google.com? Of course, it's a Linux box. Maybe it's a FreeBSD box. Could be. But it's a free software box. I'm sure of it. They're not running Vista, right? I mean, they can't be, right? They're not running Solaris. So Google is the biggest consumer of open source and free software technology, and they're the smallest contributor. They believe that the Summer of Code program, which nets maybe, what, you know, $200,000, $300,000 to free software projects at most, maybe five, that doing that once a year is enough, that's all they have to do to contribute back to this thing that made them possible. This free software thing helped make them possible. And I think we really have to have a complicated conversation with Google. We in the free software world, just everybody, all the citizens of the free software world, have to have a conversation with Google about, you know, hey, you've got to come back into our community a little bit. You've got to give something back. You've got to start to bring some of this technology back. And I think it actually relates to a much more complicated problem that I don't want to get too far into, of this idea that the way new ideas get funded is through the corporate structure. You know, the ability to get, you know, NSF grants is going down. There's less money for academic research. All the professors are going to be really happy that I'm saying this. And this idea of academia as a place to fund interesting research is a really good idea. And I think it works really well. We had, I think, throughout the 80s and 90s some technology transfer problems that we have to solve. But what's happened now is you fund new ideas in corporate America. And that means they get locked inside the corporate walls. And I think that's terribly dangerous. And I think that's what we're seeing at Google, that the best, if you want to be somebody who really works on search, you have to go work for Google. You get your PhD and you go right to Google. And 10 years ago, you went and got a PhD and went right to Microsoft Research. And now it's just Google. And that's, you know, despite the motto, I'm still worried. I'm still worried they're going to do some evil. By the way, there was a funny quote from Bill Gates about, I guess about 8 months ago, where he said, I hate everything about Google, including the motto. So does that mean Microsoft's motto is do evil? Yeah, way back there.
I always thought that the CWT was their Google's big contribution to.
Which
GWT? Google Web Toolkit.
Oh yeah, but you know it's one of these things where it's, you know, Yeah, but where are the applications, right? I mean, the applications are the big thing, right? I don't know. I mean, Google's a big company, and they could be giving back a lot more. And they should be having a negotiation with us about what to give back. I mean, it shouldn't be... I think we're past the point. I mean, there was a time when I used to go around and just beg software, you know, give us something, give FSF some money, give a little bit of software to the world, help us out. We're too important now. I mean, frankly, we've changed the technology industry, and they should be aware of that, and they should be negotiating with us. I mean, literally negotiating, saying, what does Google need to do to make the freedom world happy? And they're not. They're just saying, every once in a while, we'll throw some code over the wall. Every once in a while, we'll throw some of code over the wall. You know, that's not the same thing. And it's, I think, yes, they've contributed. Yes, there's Google employees who've sent patches to Python. Yes, there's lots of cases you can point to. Well, Google gave a little free software there. But, you know, the level to which, you know, free software systems made their business possible, I think it's not that they have a, you know, sort of a legal obligation. It's not that GPL says they have to give back. It's a more of an ethical obligation, a moral obligation that they should try to give back to the free world, given that they benefit from it. And I think we should be having that conversation with them. I don't know what is on the laundry list, right? But I think it's more than what they've done, regardless of, you know, some web tools they've released and everything else.
But isn't there a search tool? That's so valuable.
It's helpful, but, you know, I have to, you know, I don't get to learn how it works. I can't run it on my own files unless I want to give my own files to Google for them to data mine or whatever it is they do with them. So it's not really the same as giving the technology and teaching people how the technology works. I mean, that's important scientific information. How they've made search work on the internet, the world should know. The world has a right to know. And I think it's really unfortunate that they haven't slowly made that available. Yes, maybe they meet a limited time monopoly of some sort, a copyright, a patent, whatever it is. And maybe we should talk about giving them that. But it shouldn't stay locked up inside Google's walls forever. That's not fair to society, I don't think.
Just more of a comment on that. I feel like Google has given back, not necessarily giving back code or making everything open source for that, but I feel like they've made the general community, the internet community, and the general public more aware of an alternative to Microsoft. And I think that's them giving back. Like you said earlier today, people are using online docs, even though that might not be the best solution because Google has access to them then, but at least they're not using Microsoft Office exclusively. They're aware of something else in their option to open their minds a little bit.
I'm going to say something kind of crazy for somebody who used to work for the FSF before, but it's more of a personal thought. I actually think the whole Google Apps thing is more dangerous than Microsoft Office. Because at least in Microsoft Office, you can move somebody to OpenOffice, and it can work very similarly. We're going to have a much bigger challenge to replace Google Office, and I assure you, we will. I think the biggest project that needs to be started right now in the free software world is an appliance device running free software that has some sort of thing like Google Apps that you can install in a university, in Iraq, or in a business in Iraq, and it can be there on the network, and it can act like Google Apps for that organization. I think we need that like yesterday, because what we need is the ability for people to have their own Google Apps for their own employees, their own students, their own professors, their own faculty. That's what should happen. It shouldn't be locked up in Google. Everybody should have their own. If they want to get together with other people and have one that's collaborative, great. But I think that's a free software project that needs attention like yesterday, because we have to replace it. I think it's at least as dangerous as Microsoft Office, if not more dangerous, because not only do you not have the software's not even in your computer. Your computer becomes a paperweight when you're not connected to Google's network. That's frightening. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, you said earlier, basically you want Google to tell us, how the searches are working so we can learn from it and expand upon it. But then, Google can't do that. If they do that, then the search engine won't work anymore, because everyone will know how to optimize their site to get on top rankings, and then it'll just be a huge search engine optimization war, and you're in search for something that's not going to be relevant at all to what you want.
So how long should Google get a monopoly on that idea? How long? I actually think they should have a monopoly. The question is how long? 5 years? 10 years? 20 years? 50 years? 100 years? As long as Disney has copyright on Steamboat Willie? I mean, we have to make a decision as a society, right? And decide people can be monopolies for limited times. You can have a monopoly on technology. The patent system, which may be the right solution for the Google problem, the search problem, maybe. I don't know. I'm generally against software patents across the board. But maybe this is a case where I could see a good case being made for a software patent. But the whole idea of the patent system, the copyright system, all these legal mechanisms that were invented were to make sure the public good was served. We knew, as an early country, that you had to have some sort of control systems on ideas, because that inspired people to work on making ideas because they knew they could make enough to live on. But does somebody have to get mega, mega, mega rich just because they thought of an idea or thought of a bunch of ideas? I mean, look at the proprietary software history, right? Why is Bill Gates and Microsoft so, so wealthy? Is that right? Does that make sense as a society? Do we really believe that they should invent a good idea once, which really Microsoft had one good idea once, is the truth. And they've just sort of been rehashing it for all this time. And they just keep getting more and more money. There's a point to which, I mean, I'm not a socialist. I'm not a communist. I don't believe that people shouldn't make money. But I believe that there's a limit to what you should be able to make money from a single idea or a single set of ideas. Eventually, those ideas have to find their way back into the public domain for people to improve on them. Yes, you should make some money. You should make a good amount of money. You should make a good living. You should have a comfortable life. But do you need to be a billionaire? No. I don't think you should get to be a billionaire because you patented something once. And that's sort of what it comes down to in search. And yes, I agree, there would be competition. It would be tough. But that's what capitalism is, right? I mean, capitalism is not one company thinks of the thing, and then it's the only place you can go. The whole idea of capitalism, the reason it worked is because there was competition. That people got, you know, one-upped each other, and then there was a better product, then there was a better product, and people were there. And that's, by the way, how Google got there. You know, you guys, because the young ones here, you might not remember, there was a time when Google sucked, right? There was a time when we used Yahoo to search. There was a time before that when we used AltaVista to search, right? And it changed because the other ones got better. And now we've reached the pinnacle of the mountain, and it's Google, and that's all we're ever going to have. I don't think we should end there. We got to think about these issues. I think they're important to consider. I do want to get other questions. Go ahead.
Based on that same concept, should you make software free when the revelation of the source code itself actually causes software not to function correctly? For example, if Google had turned around and automatically made their source code open, then all the people on the websites would automatically be able to attune what they had to basically destroy the search engine itself. And then we have thousands of porn sites at the top of every
search. Yeah, that was probably true when Google started, but they've gotten really good at that. I mean, people reverse engineered it. This is the classic thing of people say that you know, like somebody recently said to me, that the software in airplanes shouldn't be free because the airplanes would crash. That just 2 hours ago somebody said that to me.
Who could have it been?
And the thing is that if the software is so fragile that somebody seeing the source code means that they immediately find a way to circumvent, you know, whatever it's trying to do and screw up whatever it's trying to do, then it's not very good software. And it's dangerous even in its proprietary form because people can reverse engineer. People can figure out how it works. People did. There was a time on Google when porn, there were certain terms you searched for. In fact, I think if you search for Britney Spears now, it's probably the porn is the first hit. Right? People still scam that system. And Google constantly tries to work against them, but the fact that they don't have the source code doesn't really slow them down that much. It doesn't slow them down that much. Yeah, go ahead.
You said Microsoft had one good idea once. What was it?
I don't know. I think probably.
Software
license. That might. I don't know if that's a good idea. It's probably a bad idea. I don't know. I think generally the idea of I think it was good that Microsoft came with BASIC by default. I think that was important. I think that all the early computers coming with a programming language was a good idea. It doesn't anymore, strangely enough. But you have to like pay, what, $1 billion to get a copy of Visual Studio or something? But there was a time when you got your programming language with your operating system. It should be that way. So that's probably one.
Do you think Wikipedia or DLive be an alternative to Google?
I don't know much about what DMOS has been doing in recent years. I kind of got the impression it was kind of defunct, but Wikipedia is important and a really important project, but I think it's sort of different in its goal because it's not designed about search. It's designed about collecting information, which then has to be indexed by a search, right? So I think it's difficult to sort of say Wikipedia is what Google is. I mean, usually you use Google to find a Wikipedia page, you know, so that's an issue. As for other things, DMOS, I don't know. I haven't looked at DMOS in probably 6 years.
But it's still very important to put your site in the DMOS.
I think it's good.
I think
you're right. I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea to use DMOS. I just don't know if it's going to have the kind of momentum that will be needed to make an alternative search engine that can compete with Google. Because Google has a lot of money and power now. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I just wondered if you've been following the issue with Blackboard and the sort of proprietary law
lawsuits, the hereditary Blair-Wine lawsuits?
I believe it's public knowledge that the Sulphur Freedom Law Center is working on that issue with a client. And if you Google around, you'll find that. Google. Strange to say that after what I just said. But because there's a client issue involved, I work for a law firm now, I really can't comment because I don't want to accidentally waive attorney-client privilege. So, Google, and there's a lot of stuff been said. I mean, I know that Evan Mogul and my boss has said a number of things in public about it, so you can find his statements and so forth. It's an important issue, though. I don't want to make it seem like it's not. It is important, but I really can't comment about it.
Part of the internet that Google gave us is that the importance of you linking someone determines their weight, right? That's the basic of the search algorithm. Wikipedia now no longer links, is no longer searched by Google to say what it links out to. All links are banned outward, so that if Wikipedia links to you, you don't gain any importance. They're trying to prevent spamming. But isn't that kind of against the concept of kind of sharing?
Yeah, I agree. I didn't know that. That's the first time I heard that. I apologize for not knowing that fact, but it's a good fact. I'm glad I know it. That's bad. I mean, that's a good decision Google made?
No. This is a decision Wikipedia made, and they were saying they might revoke it at some point. The problem is they did it to try and spite link spam for people linking, trying to spam Google.
So how do they stop Google? They put something in the A tag?
The A tag or the .robots file, I think.
Oh, either your privacy subtext, yeah.
Google has a smart dot robots file version.
Okay, I see. So they put something around. Yeah. It's complicated. I think it's bad. I don't like it. I mean, my immediate reaction is that's bad. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, it's sort of fighting bad with bad because the way Google works is, you know, sort of dictated by Google. And, you know, and Wikipedia has trouble, you know, with lockdown issues. And Stephen Colbert, while he's very funny and great, didn't really help us with that one. I guess go torrent that episode of Stephen Colbert's report. It's probably on YouTube. Yeah, everything's on YouTube. I don't use YouTube because it uses Flash, and I don't have Flash on my computer because it's proprietary software. So.
They just opened it. Well, it's proprietary.
Well, they're talking about. They haven't done it. They're talking about maybe making Flash free software. I hope they do, but.
Not yet.
Flash 2. Yeah. They tend to update that. Well, you can get Flash 8 or whatever the newest version is on free software systems. It's proprietary software, and I don't use proprietary software. So. More questions? More comments, complaints, everything else?
What do you think about Sugar and CEO? The business model is open source software.
I don't. I have to claim ignorance. What is Sugar? Well, I mean, I know it's a sweetener, but
it's a CRM or customer relationship management.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Business operating system that's open source. And some companies, are publishing companies or subscription companies, are running their companies by using this open source software called Sugar.
It sounds good to me. I don't know much about the product itself to comment specifically on it, but if it's open source and free software and people find it useful, generally I think it's a good thing. Yeah, go ahead.
What do you think is the biggest challenge facing the open source free software movement?
I mean, I think it's ultimately DRM and the issues of whether or not technology is going to be locked down in the future.
Actually narrow that down a bit. What do you think about adoption issues?
Adoption issues is a good question. I think that we're still in this sort of annoying desktop challenge, and I find it really unfortunate that we're still there. You know, the Ubuntu guys have done a wonderful job, but I feel like we should be where we are now, like 6 years ago. And it really, really, I think, was really bad for us. And a lot of companies, a lot of the startups, you know, Zimian's a great example, which was bought by Novell. You know, they really worked hard. I mean, I know Nat Friedman and Miguel, who worked for Zimian, and they worked really, really hard trying to get desktops into businesses, you know, desktop environments based on GNU Linux systems, and they really had trouble. You know, it was really hard to get people to move, and it's part of it's because it's not really all there yet. It's just not as easy, particularly on laptops. That's always been the challenge, that there's all these problems people have. I was talking in a walkover, you know, Dapper, which was the long-term support version of Ubuntu, they happened to ship with a Linux kernel that didn't support Hibernate because it broke for a while in Linux, and it's fixed again, but you know, sort of the version that was sort of this is the one we're going to support for a while, didn't have Hibernate. It's just sort of one of these things like, oh, guys, why? You know, people need to Hibernate their laptops, and it doesn't work. And sort of the other side of what I do besides doing this political and legal stuff, you know, I'm sort of also the CTO of the law firm, and I'm handling the technology, and I've got a bunch of users that can't hibernate the laptops. And those kinds of things I think we've got to do something about. And I hope Shuttleworth's way of doing it is going to work. I don't know for sure if it will. But I really think that whole desktop thing is the biggest challenge in adoption. It has to be there. And there's also the sort of more general challenge of file formats and the idea that Office is going to come out, the new version, and it's not going to be compatible with OpenOffice, and they'll have to scramble to reverse engineer it. And that's related to the desktop thing, right? I mean, I don't know how we track OpenOffice file formats better, and ODF is a great idea, and OpenOffice supports it just great, but Microsoft is making ODF a second-class citizen. ODF's the open document format. It's supposed to be the thing that is going to be standard and not patented and available for all word processors to use. So those are really the toughest things as far as getting people to adopt. I think the server space is done. I don't think if somebody actually proposes, I want to run a Microsoft server, I think they would be laughed out of any IT room in any business these days. I mean, nobody thinks, oh yeah, my new server is going to be Microsoft. I mean, if there are people saying that, I'd kind of be surprised, and I think they don't have a lot of hope. I mean, even like, you know, things like with Samba, right? It's like, you know, you could do an NT domain controller with all the things you need for authentication on Windows with the GNU Linux box running Samba. You know, I don't know why people would do Microsoft servers these days.
Do you feel that DRM is going to become a more interesting threat once virtualization becomes a more important aspect of computing? With being able to protect, now get better hardware things, you have things like virtualization hooks that are able to grab those bit streams, be able to take them out in different, basically a different operating system running on the, bit stream of a different thing running on. Just opening up the hardware basically.
Yeah, virtualization is a really interesting moment, for virtualization, because it's one of the most interesting things to the free software people, and it's really interesting to Microsoft, too. And I don't know whether that's because Microsoft realizes their goose is cooked, and they have to live with the fact that people want to buy a server once, and if they really do need a Microsoft server for some reason I don't understand, they have to put it on the same computer as their GNU Linux box, and that's why they need virtualization. But it's really weird that there's this adoption on both sides, in the free software world and Microsoft world, about virtualization. Now, what I will say about virtualization that's interesting is the most interesting platform for virtualization right now, it's not all there yet, but it's really close, is Xen, and that's free software. And it's based on CUMA, which is a free software architecture platform, which is also GPL. So I think the future of virtualization is free software if we do virtualization. I don't know what it means for the kind of things you're asking about, because we won't know until it happens, like how it's going to affect and so forth. I think Microsoft's push for virtualization is sort of a last-ditch effort to try and figure out a way to keep the server market going, and I think they're not going to succeed. I think their server market goose is cooked, and they're just going to have to fight for the desktop now. And then we got three players there, with Apple. Yeah, go ahead.
I have one more question.
Okay, so I got one more question. Who gets their hand up for you?
Do you think that net neutrality and DRM mixed together are going to mix into the whole game? Do you see large corporations coming in and just taking a stranglehold and forcing everything into a small number of media outlets the way that they did with radio and TV?
Well, I don't think the whole net neutrality debate is going to go very far. I think that everybody's sort of said that we want the internet the way it is. I mean, especially with the congressional change, it was a big issue when the Republicans were in Congress. You have what's his name from Alaska, the senator from Alaska.
Stevens.
Yeah, you have Stevens up there giving the speech. I mean, and the Daily Show just did. Well, it's funny. I have a funny story about that. The day that happened, I actually had live tickets to see the Daily Show, so I actually saw that the whole thing about the series of tubes. And I'm in the room with the Daily Show. And the funny thing is I play a hell of a lot of poker, so he connected it all up to the poker thing. And it was really great to see, this is sort of the showing like how much people in the lobby world, because I mean, Stevens was reading from a lobbyist script, right? I mean, that's why he didn't know what he was saying, because some lobbyist handed him a script to go in and say, and you read this, and it was probably talking points, because he sort of says things that vaguely sound right as he's talking. He says, my staff sent me an internet 2 weeks ago, and I just got the internet, and that's what happens to your personal internet when it's a big truck and not a series of tubes. And so he had these talking points that he didn't understand that was handed to him by lobbyists. And I think that sort of shows that people don't understand. And the lobbyists on the other side, who just want the internet to stay the way it is, which is a really big lobby. I mean, basically everybody in the industry doesn't want this except for like the MPAA and other types of people. Maybe some of the ISPs do, but I don't really think so. So I don't think net neutrality is an issue. DRM is an issue, but I don't think they're really going to be married in that way, because I don't think then the whole net neutrality thing has a lot of legs one way or the other. I think it's status quo for the internet generally, but DRM is up in the air. I mean, there could be a major, like, a widespread adoption of DRM, or DRM could just not make it. I think both are at least equally likely. I don't think I'd bet anything other than even money. Okay, so we're done.
Well, thanks for coming out, everybody. I really appreciate it. I hope you had a good time. And those of you who are RFPT and go to Don Pablo's with us, I hope you continue having a good time. We have, I think, one or two more spaces available if anyone who is not aware. Don